The Bob Murphy Show, episode 394.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. Today I'm going to be interviewing Cody Cook, who is an author and theologian living in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is the author of The Anarchist Anabaptist and a regular contributor and podcast host at the Libertarian Christian Institute. So what Cody and I are going to be talking about this episode is his book, The Anarchist Anabaptist. I think we can just dive right in because everything's going to be pretty self-explanatory. We had a nice discussion, and I should also mention Cody later gave me a link to his debate on pacifism with Jacob Winograd, who I've had a lot of conversations with. And that was an excellent debate, meaning does Jesus command pacifism? And he and Jacob, I both thought, did a great job of, you know, using both common sense, but also scripture to explain where they're coming from. And I, you know, it was the kind of thing where every time one guy spoke, I was like, see that? And the next guy, good. So I'll link to that if you're curious. Without further ado, here's my discussion with Cody. Cody, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me here. Excited to meet you.
Yeah, nice to make your virtual acquaintance as well. So the focus of our discussion today will be your book that's relatively recently published from the Libertarian Christian Institute Press called The Anarchist Anabaptist, Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom by Cody Cook. Okay. So maybe before we – there's a couple chapters in particular that I think would be juicy for us to dive into. But maybe just for one thing, probably explain how did you become an Anabaptist and how did you become an anarchist? Maybe those are two good places to start.
Yeah, I guess sort of slowly but surely. there was kind of a connection between the two that I was sort of discovering. So like I grew up in a family that my dad's side was my mom's side was nominally Christian. My dad's side was Southern Baptist. Mm-hmm. And so I was probably an atheist by the time I was like 10. And then sort of found my way back to it. I spent a lot of time with this kind of sort of vaguely anti-authoritarian sort of approach that would sort of swing sometimes between kind of like libertarianism, but maybe I wasn't super familiar with the word or the ideology, but, you know, sort of through guys like Alex Jones, that type of libertarianism. And then I'd sort of also swing back to like kind of this sort of left wing sort of 60s radical, you know, Abby Hoffman, Black Panthers type thing. And so then, you know, I kind of found myself back in Christianity sort of for various reasons. But including having certain difficulties that I was having, you know, apologetics issues resolved. But and then so I kind of maintained that sort of suspicion of authority. And it ended up being, I think, kind of led me into a certain kind of Christianity and also a certain kind of political philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that would be, you know, libertarianism as a kind of, the most consistent way to be suspicious of authority and to sort of, you know, dislike political power and power over others. And then as you know, I became a Christian, I have sort of an obsessive compulsive, you know, type of personality. So I wanted to dig in and understand it. And so I kind of went off to Bible college within sort of like a year of becoming a Christian. And, kind of from there, you know, spending a lot of time reading and researching and looking in church history. And I kept coming across these folks called the Anabaptists. Mm-hmm. And they were really interesting because they came out of that, sort of came out of the Protestant Reformation. I mean, I think you could say that without the Protestant Reformation, you wouldn't have had the Anabaptists. But what made them really different from the Catholics and the Protestants is that the Catholics and the Protestants pretty much agreed that the church had to be propped up by the force of government. That there was this kind of state church idea that was not really something they would really be suspicious of or contest in any way. It was like just, it was kind of the air they breathed, you know, it made mm-hmm. sense to them. And then you had these people, the Anabaptists, who said, you know, actually, I think that, you have to be like sincere to be a Christian. Like you actually have to believe it. There's, you have to consent to it. It has to be voluntary or else it's not real, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there were a number of kind of doctrines that they sort of derived from that. So one would be what they're named for, which is adult baptism. So Anabaptist means rebaptizer. So that was what their enemies called them, because they felt that, you know, there's all kinds of theological reasons why you might baptize infants. But they in particular objected to the political rationalization. And the political rationalization that was being made was that you are baptized into the church state. So to be baptized was not only to be a member of the church, it was to be a member, to be a citizen, really, right? The only people who weren't baptized pretty much were Jews, and they weren't treated as equal citizens. And so Anabaptists felt like, well, babies can't choose to be baptized. And so, you know, they opposed the idea that they should be baptized. They said they felt like once baptism is this commitment to following Christ, allegiance to Christ. And so it's not something you can sort of, it's not a decision that someone else can make for you. But they had other things too. So, I mean, they had that separation from church and state idea. And in particular, it's violent functions. So they were also pacifists. So they felt that there may be some legitimate function that violence could perform, but it was outside of what they called the perfection of Christ. And so they sort of felt that maybe pagans would need violence to keep each other in line. But when it came to the church, it was a voluntary organization. So Anabaptist members of their churches were all sort of there because they wanted to be there. And so they may practice certain forms of church discipline, but they were all nonviolent. There were things like shunning, which I think today we see as kind of backwards, but at the time it was incredibly progressive mm-hmm. because the only alternative to shunning was we kill you, right? That was mm-hmm. what the Protestants and the Catholics were doing. So today, I mean, just for those who may not be familiar with the Anabaptist movement, there's like groups today, like the Mennonites, the Amish, the Hutterites, that are descended from those original Anabaptists. There are, unfortunately, also lots of theological liberals and statists today who would identify with the Anabaptist movement. But if you look at the early Anabaptist confessions, you look at the early leaders, they're largely going to be opposed to violence. They're going to be opposed to statism. And they're going to feel that way for theologically conservative reasons, that they believe the Bible clearly taught those things. And so...
Can I just ask you in terms of the taxonomy, I guess? So is it because in the beginning you were saying how the Anabaptists were in a sense distinct even from the Protestants, let alone the Catholics. So like right now, like somebody who's Amish, if you said to them, hey, are you Protestant? Would they say, no, I'm Anabaptist? Or is that not how it works?
They would probably deny that. So there's a sense in which they're kind of Protestant and a sense in which they're kind of not. Mm-hmm. So like the earliest Anabaptist came from Switzerland under kind of the leadership of a guy named Ulrich Zwingli. And Zwingli was this guy who was probably also a believer in adult baptism, and he held to a lot of their same views. But he found himself with a seat at the table in the government, and that put him in a place where he felt like, okay, we should move slowly. We should move deliberately. We sort of have the state on our side. And he had some followers who basically said, we think that we just need to follow what the Bible says, and we really don't care what the state has to say. And they separated. And so actually almost 500 years to the day, it was just a couple months ago, his followers sort of separated out and baptized each other as adults. Mm-hmm. And that started the Anabaptist movement. So like I said, you know, Zwingli's a Protestant. So in a sense, they've come from Protestantism, but they also really, I think, challenged a lot of what were sort of key Reformation ideas, So it's kind of complicated, basically.
Okay. Among other things, like, and I know this doesn't contradict what you're saying, but like many Protestant churches now would have adult baptism, or not adult, right. You know, like not infant. You know what I mean? They might say, oh yeah, that's a weird Catholic thing or something. So
yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Whereas the early Protestants were all infant baptizers. Right. So, and there's a sense in which I think over time you've seen kind of the victory of Anabaptism in a way, because evangelicals have come to a lot of these viewpoints that Anabaptists were getting murdered for. And they said, yeah, of course we should separate church and state. And yeah, of mm-hmm. course, you know, adult baptism is fine. mm-hmm. But at the time they really separated them from the Protestant movement.
I just need to say real quickly, Cody, it just popped into my head. I haven't thought of this in years on the issue of, you know, clearly you would think if you think that someone's salvation is from accepting Jesus and, you know, whatever mm-hmm. that means to you, that surely that has to be voluntary. You can't, you know, someone can't force you to be saved. When I was a TA or a research assistant, I should say, for Mario Rizzo at NYU, he had this honors seminar. And for some reason, I don't even remember what the reason was we were looking at it, but there was a thing from like a Catholic scholar, like talking about the Inquisition mm-hmm. and trying to explain. And the guys, and I don't want to say like a famous Catholic theologian name, then like I'm getting the wrong guy, so I won't say a name, but in terms of who wrote it. But the argument was, it was something like, yes, of course, like applying physical distress to somebody to get them to confess Christ or whatever wouldn't count, but it can make you focus the mind, you know? So in other words, it was like, if you really want to teach someone the Pythagorean theorem and you said, yeah. I'm going to chop your hand off if you can't learn this, you know, it might make them really study it. And so then they would really know it, you know, but anyway, it was that kind of, anyway, I thought that was funny.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the application of pressure. Yeah. And I think even a lot of the early Protestants and even like Christian nationalists today would sort of acknowledge that you can't force somebody to be Christian, mm-hmm. but they mm-hmm. say, well, what you can do is you can use force to get them to shut up. And so, mm-hmm. And I think that their hope is that if all the people with bad ideas keep their mouths closed,
then
the good ideas will prevail, as opposed to sort of putting people in this position where you actually don't know who is sincere and who's not, because everybody's sort of obligated to lie.
Yep. Okay. So great. So, all right. So there, so thank you for that. And then, I mean, I know pacifism is interwoven into your book. Is that something that is like tied at the hip, joined at the hip with Anabaptism, or is it not necessarily?
Yes, it is. So, this is one of the things about definitions, right? They're, you know, always useful, but never entirely accurate, because there's always things on the fringes. So the amongst the earliest Anabaptists, pacifism is there pretty much right from the beginning, but you do have some debates. Not everybody's totally on board. And the worst example was there were a number of Anabaptists who took over the city of Munster, believing that the New Jerusalem was going to basically Munster was the New Jerusalem. The end of days was coming. And they even sort of said, well, sure, pacifism, but that's only until Jesus comes back. And we're saying that Jesus is coming back, so now we can use violence. And that ended about as badly as you could imagine it would. And sort of from there, that was like pretty much in the first generation. Mm-hmm. From there, you have all the kind of other leaders like Meadow Simons and Balthasar Hubmaier and all these guys saying, okay, that was a bad idea. Like, that is not something we can ever do again. And so mm-hmm. I think it really sort of, you know, pacifism was already a pretty major idea in Anabaptism, but those who were the exceptions to the rule ended up, I think, making sure that it was going to become something that was going mm-hmm. to remain with Anabaptism.
Can I ask you, the episode you're referring to, like, was it horrific?
It was pretty bad.
I mean, because I listened to, I remember a Dan Carlin Hardcore History on something, and I think it's what you're talking, and it was just like, ugh, like it's like the worst thing I've ever heard.
it was really bad. So, and the stuff they tried to do was really weird too, because you had these sort of charismatic leaders who felt mm-hmm. that they were like, I'm the new Elijah or I'm the new whatever. Mm-hmm. And they took all the doors off the houses because they were like, well, you know, we're brothers and sisters and everything's owned communally now. Mm-hmm. And they like sort of forced polygamy. And, but anyways,
yeah, I think we're talking about, and then the way they punished the guy who was like the ringleader at the end was like disgusting. Folks, if I can find it, if you're into that, but it was, yeah, it was a very interesting hardcore. It was very hardcore and it was historical. So there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sorry. So can I ask you also, Cody, did they, the pacifism that was embedded, was it a direct, was it merely just, you know, oh yeah, pragmatically speaking, we think this is the right way to do, or was it, no, I mean, the Sermon on the Mountain, we were like, he's clearly saying, you know, turn the other cheek and, you know, so forth. And
yes. So, I mean, there's early Anabaptism was very what we would call today pietistic. That doesn't mean that there weren't sort of, you know, intellectuals who are making, you know, really good systematic arguments, but they were not as concerned with kind of thinking in terms of like, what's a practical political theory. It was more in terms of what does it mean if Christ is our King and Christ is our Lord? And so the Sermon on the Mount, you know, different traditions will sort of maybe focus on different passages of scripture or different books that they sort of feel are sort of focusing. Like Protestants really look at the letters of Paul. For Anabaptists, the Sermon on the Mount was really central. Mm-hmm. And there's other passages as well that I think helped sort of inform the way they thought about it. Like when Jesus talks about how, you know, with pagans, they sort of rule over each other, but it shouldn't be that way with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he gives a sort of real different way, like the world is this way, you're that way. And but yeah, the Sermon on that was really a big part of that. And it was just this idea that if we're following Christ, we should follow Christ. And, you know, Protestants and Catholics have come up with all kinds of explanations for why we don't really have to follow the Sermon on the Mount. So the Catholic rationale, which Martin Luther objected to, was that, well, this is for certain like super Christians, the people we call saints, but regular people can't really do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, but over time, all these different rationales, like, well, maybe this is supposed to remind us of our sinfulness because we can't live up to it. So we shouldn't even really try.
Yeah.
Or different things like that.
So is that maybe when you said earlier, you said something like, because I asked you a pretty broad question, like a twofer, that, hey, how'd you become an Anabaptist and how'd you become an anarchist? And you were saying like they kind of informed each other. Because I recently did an essay that is probably coming out very soon now that I'm thinking about it for the Libertarian Christian Institute about.
It's already out now.
I think it is.
It might have been today as as we're speaking.
That's kind of interesting. So, and that was one of the things I put in there that, so tell me, Cody, if this resonates with you, that it's not a coincidence that, you know, I went as a Christian and then my libertarianism, because I realized a lot of the conventional, you know, standard secular libertarian reason rejection of pacifism seemed very similar to me to why a statist would say, well, no, you got to have taxation. You got to, you know what I mean? Like all the stuff they would just throw at you. And as a libertarian, you know, but still with the believer in defensive force or violence, you could, you know, knock that all down. I said, no. You're not even thinking about it. You're not even giving it a shot. Like, just take, you know, voluntary society at face value and let's give, you know, don't just reject it after considering for 8 seconds and you go through. And so then likewise, I realized, well, no, just to say, well, if you had pacifism, all the banks would get robbed. And say,
right.
Well, no, they can still have vaults. They can still have, you know, nets and you know what I mean? Like, or you can have the money can be marked if it's gold, whatever. You can trace the criminals and figure out who, you know, and then have other mechanisms to boycott them or do whatever. You know what I mean? So I was just saying, I didn't prove, therefore, pacifism's awesome, but I'm just saying a lot of the knee-jerk, you know, dismissals about, oh, you idiot, is the same kind of response I would get when telling someone who believed in the state that, oh, yeah, you could get it by without taxation. And they're saying, oh, give me a break, you hippie. So anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, one last thing. And then that kind of gave me permission to say maybe Jesus actually meant what he was saying and wasn't using it as hyperbole.
Yeah, yeah. Libertarianism and pacifism are sort of like it's kind of like accidentally stumbling on something that works. It's like when they were giving Viagra out as heart medication, and then like, hey, this does something else that actually works really well. And that wasn't even what we were trying to do. I think, you know, for me, you know, libertarianism was very attractive because it seemed like a very consistent application of these starting principles that just are kind of like you can't really question them, right? It's like it's obvious that it's wrong to initiate force against peaceful people, but then we sort of say, yeah, but that breaks down at a certain level, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think what drew me into pacifism, what drew me into libertarianism, was the fact that it seemed very consistent with these sort of ethical commands that I think are just kind of irrefutable. But then once you start doing it and thinking about it and working it through, you're like, okay, this works in ways that I didn't expect it to. And so like, there's a, for example, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan wrote this book, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. And that looks at nonviolence as sort of a political movement, like, so mm-hmm. kind of like revolution, civil resistance, that kind of thing. And what they found, which I think would be surprising to a lot of people, is that organized nonviolent resistance is actually more effective than violent resistance. Mm-hmm. And that's surprising because we tend to associate violence with doing something. Right. And we sort of see, you know, we think that pacifism, that the root of pacifism is passive instead of, you know, peace. And so, but I think what we've sort of, I think, discovered is that these approaches end up being a lot more effective than we expect them to. As I know you've talked about this before, you know, if you're even like a kind of an ANCAP society, we would be very suspicious of using violence as kind of our starting point, that we would always try just because it makes the most sense and it causes the least amount of headaches and it's going to mm-hmm. be the most effective and less disruptive, is you're going to say, how do we resolve this nonviolently or with the least amount of violence possible? And as a starting point, that just, it's not just moral, it's practical.
Yeah. So love all that. And you're right that it's to, my big thing lately is to say to people, when you're picturing a Christian and even a pacifist, don't think of Ned Flanders. You know what I mean? Like, it just written like a doormat. That's not what it means. Or to say, like, blessed are the meek. Don't think that means let everyone just walk all over you and don't, you know, no, it's actually, you know, like, get better role models. And like, that's why I love Mel Gibson's movie. Oh, shoot. The Seventh Day Adventist that was the medic? What is that called?
Yeah, it's a great movie. And for some reason, I'm blanking on the name. Yeah, so it was about Desmond Doss.
Yes.
And it was called Ridge.
Ruby Ridge. That's
Hacksaw Ridge.
Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah. We moved on to another libertarian talking point.
Yes. Ruby Ridge shows why violence is bad. So there you go. So that's a good example just to show, like, no, in fact, in many situations, to not use violence when it's readily available is actually far more courageous than refraining from it. So anyway, obviously, like, you know, you can go watch The Passion. You know, that's another Mel Gibson movie to show, huh, that guy's certainly not a coward. And look at what he just went through. And because he was really committed to his principles, and actually that was the salvation of the world. So there you go.
Yes. Yeah.
Not a bad outcome.
No, not at all. Well, or, you know, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. the Velvet Revolution. I mean, these are examples of, I mean, you know, you wouldn't look at what the civil rights movement did in the 60s and think, what a bunch of wimps. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think, you know, maybe at some level, I know Malcolm X once privately said to Martin Luther King's wife that I'm here to remind the white establishment that if they don't listen to your husband, they'll have to deal with me. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, when you look at what was really, I think, effective, it was not that sort of threat that things could get worse. It was people who maybe probably were, you know, kind of racist, but they day after day seeing like police dogs attacking you know, children and women and stuff. They got, maybe I don't really want to like share a water fountain with these people, but this is horrible. It does something to your humanity to see that.
And also too, just to stress for people that and I hit this stuff a lot on this podcast, but it really was like a strategy. Like it was a technique. Mm. It wasn't merely, you know, there were a lot of religious people that thought, you know, this is what God wants us to do. But, and I saw it was a great thing. Where the heck was I? Was I in Nashville? I can't remember where I was, but there was some like exhibit to the nonviolent resistance civil rights movement. And there was this training session, and it was like at a place where they were going to do a bunch of sit-ins at a lunch counter, you know, a segregated lunch counter. And the training they gave the people beforehand was to say, okay, we're just going to sit there. And then, you know, if people come in and if they start like spitting on you and especially if they start punching you, like you just engage them, like say, hey, why are you spitting on me? Like, what's the, you know what I mean? Like try to get them. Because it's kind of hard if you're talking to someone to keep hitting them, you know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, your two modes of interaction are conflicting. And then they also had a technique where it was like they were going to form rings of the protesters, you know, the sit-in people. And it's like an outer ring taking the punishment. And then if they needed a break, they would go into the interior. And then the people who had been in the interior would go out and form the perimeter and then take the spitting and the punching. And so, I mean, it was... So say what you will about that. That's not just, oh yeah, you babies are afraid to throw a punch. No, that's not what it was at all. Right. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Okay. So maybe we'll get into your book at this point. We could just keep dwelling on that. So the thing that really, you know, for, as far as the audience here who may not be all interested in the intricacies of Protestantism and its various branches and whatnot. So I liked your chapter five, The Limits of Libertarianism, jumped out at me. And so you motivate that at the beginning. You're saying that, you know, we definitely think that the average, especially like in the U.S. context, the average, especially like right wing conservative Christian who's real gung ho about the military and rah rah and USA, that there's a lot they could learn from libertarianism and realize things about that. But then you flip it and say, okay, but what can the secular or agnostic libertarian learn from Christianity? So can you speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, so there's different, I guess, approaches to kind of how libertarianism is thought of as an ethic. I mean, some might argue that like libertarianism as a political ethic is fairly complete, that it sort of tells you what's unacceptable to do. And then that sort of gives you room to kind of develop what else, you know, what is acceptable, right? So non-aggression principle, fine, that sounds good. But the problem, I think, with libertarianism, and it's not really a problem, it's just the way it is that it tells us that the initiation of force is wrong. And it does also tell us that the only just order is a voluntary one, and that's great. But there's actually more that we need to know when it comes to our ethics, when it comes to determining what we value and how we should live our lives. So some might distinguish between the silver rule and the golden rule. Mm-hmm. So the golden rule comes from Jesus: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The silver rule is very similar to it, but it's not quite the same. It's don't do to others what you don't want done to you. So the silver rule is like the non-aggression principle. Mm-hmm. But the golden rule asks you to do more than that, right? So the silver rule might say, you know, don't harm your neighbors. But the golden rule would say, love your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the silver rule might say, you know, don't put people in jail for feeding the homeless. But the golden rule would say, maybe you should actually feed the homeless.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah. So libertarianism, I think, tells us that we're free to value what we want, but it doesn't actually tell us what we should want to value. And that's really, I think, the most important limit of libertarianism, and is that it really can't tell us what should be important to us and how we should live our lives, other than just sort of in a negative sense. And that's all that it's meant to do, because we're talking about libertarianism as a philosophy that's kind of rooted in the idea of negative rights. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't actually tell you what you have to do. And that's not a bug. That's the feature of it. Right.
Right.
But that also means that you can't build a culture or an ethical system on just libertarianism, because libertarianism on its own can't create a culture of love or patience, peace, fidelity, generosity. It can give us the freedom to create that kind of culture, but it can't actually do it on its own. So in order to create that kind of culture, we need values, I think, that go beyond just leave people alone. It's a great start. I think it's the least we should be able to expect from those around us. I'm not opposed to leaving people alone, but I'd prefer, I mean, I think most of us would prefer to live in a society where people actually care about and value one another, as opposed to just leaving each other alone. And I think Christianity is, I think, one way, and I would argue the best way, to give us the kind of the moral foundation for that kind of society. It affirms the voluntarious stuff as kind of a starting point, but it also gives us a model to imitate. And that's Jesus, the incarnate God who comes down and sets aside his divine rights and gives himself for those who didn't deserve it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a love and a generosity and a kindness, something that's positive as opposed to just that sort of negative idea that we find in libertarianism.
Yeah, like when I was thinking about this kind of stuff, I was saying, yeah, definitely I think Christianity is consistent with libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, like, so what does libertarianism say, like, versus statism, or just, you know, kind of the average American, they might say, I'm not a statist, what are you talking about? But, you know, just the average political person in the United States in terms of their political framework and whatnot, that libertarianism says, no, just because you think you're going to do something, or the government's going to do something good with the money, like set up soup kitchens and whatever, and make kids go to school and learn how to read and write and everything, you can't use coercion against admittedly innocent people. You just can't do it. You can't take money from people against their will, even if you think you're going to spend that on a good cause. So it's kind of limiting the scope of acceptable actions against other people. And certainly, you know, but still, libertarianism in and of itself is consistent with punishing bad guys. You know, yeah, if somebody comes up and punches you in the face, libertarianism, at least in the Rothbardian version, says you can't just, you know, take out a machete and chop. Well, for sure, you can't go kill his family. And again, depending on the situation, if you don't have any further fear of the guy and he punches you and you know that's the end of it, you can maybe punch him twice, depending on, you know, the legalities or whatever. But that's it. You can't chop his head off. And yeah, so it's kind of limiting the retaliation. But yet you can certainly do to him what he did to you. Like, you're totally, you know, on solid libertarian ground as far as that's concerned. But yeah, then Christianity just takes it further. So Christianity would, you know, endorse all that and say, yeah, obviously, you know, like, or put it, this is probably a simpler way. I could have done this from the beginning, that, you know, an eye for an eye, you know, libertarianism consistent with, and like I said, Walter Block and Rothbard even argue two eyes for an eye, that, you know, you get the compensation, then you get to do the other person the thing. But clearly you can't do more than that, so it limits it. But then, yeah, obviously Jesus teaching, no, even an eye for an eye, I'm saying don't do that. So it just pushes it further. So it's like, to me as a Christian, I'm saying, yeah, the libertarians are right, especially when they're arguing with people who don't even believe in the NAP, but that's not the full journey. And also too, I like, it's not just that it's a coincidence, like for a lot of the same types of reasons. And when you can see that, oh yeah, cause don't you see, if you want to feed the homeless and you want kids to learn how to write, in the long run, you will promote that more if you don't immediately resort to coercion. You know what I mean? Like, you, it's not just that, oh yeah, there's these abstract rules, like you can't initiate coercion or aggression, but gosh darn it, there's all these homeless people I wish we could feed, and now we can't. It's like, no, in a society that actually obeyed the NAP, there would be fewer homeless people and there would be more wealth, you know, through voluntary soup kitchen and whatnot, blah, blah, blah. So likewise, too, to say, well, yeah, but, you know, if somebody comes up and robs a bank, we got to be able to throw that guy in a cage and shoot him. And I want to say, no, in the long run, actually, if society actually tried to, if 99% endorsed the Sermon on the Mount and tried to literally live that, I actually think there would be fewer bank robberies in the long run. So, you know, that kind of idea.
Well, and there's a distinction that I would make that I think is sort of helpful, which is the distinction between natural rights and Christian responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And the New Testament is fine with both. And so, you know, the New Testament would not say you don't have a right to self-defense. It acknowledges those rights.
Yep.
But it says Jesus set aside his rights and he did something even greater. And that's our model. And so as a Christian, you know, we're called to imitate that, even though we have a right to do something different.
Yeah, great. Yeah, that's kind of my standard thing with people ask about like the death penalty and stuff. And my take is, I say, I think in a libertarian society, especially one that was like with American values, you know, because it would depend, like if it was just a bunch of Muslims or something, I don't know what would happen. But if it were like our society now, but everyone just became Rothbardian next Thursday, and that was like the one tweak, but everything else was the same, I think, yeah, if somebody killed somebody, then the libertarian court would say, you know, the people who inherited the right to take vengeance, you technically can insist that the killer gets killed, you know, capital punishment. But I think in practice, that would just be considered inhumane, and that, you know, there'd be insurance companies and blah, you know, things where the killer would like buy back that right from you in exchange for, you know, $1 million payment. And that would just be because over time, and that, you know, it would be considered barbaric to insist upon, no, you did this, and so therefore I want you dead. That they would just be like, yeah, you could do that legally, but come on, you know. So okay. I like the way you're that distinction you're making.
Good. Thanks.
Folks, let's take a break from the action to discuss today's sponsor, who is Monetary Metals. Now, Monetary Metals offers you the ability to grow your wealth outside of the banking system and gain greater control over your finances through gold and silver. You can increase your precious metal content every single month. You get paid not in terms of dollars, but you get paid in physical ounces of gold and or silver. Monetary Metals is revolutionizing how people invest in these precious metals. Instead of paying to own your metal through storage costs and insurance, now you can get paid to own it. Now, right now, and this is new to the listeners of the Bob Murphy Show, there's an opportunity for you to earn 4% on gold paid in gold in Monetary Metals Marketplace. The interest you earn is paid in ounces of physical gold or silver, which you get in addition to any price appreciation from the metals that may occur during the year. So the question is this: why would you want to earn in dollars when you can earn in gold? Join thousands of investors, including myself, who are earning interest in physical gold and silver every month at Monetary Metals. For more information, go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy. Once again, go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy.
Okay. So then let's jump ahead. Chapter 10 is entitled, Was the American Revolution Sinful? So do you want to set the stage for that one?
Sure thing. Yeah, and I was going to say, you're mentioning chapter names. I don't remember if we've mentioned the name of the book or not yet, which is The Anarchist.
I said it. Yeah, I said it at the beginning.
Okay, good. Yeah, The Anarchist Anabaptist. So yes, so chapter 10. So that's, yeah, there's an essay there in chapter 10 where I'm interacting with the work of David Brousseau, who's an Anabaptist thinker today, who's done some really interesting work, who I like a lot. But I took issue with something he had to say. He argues for a very provocative thesis in his own book, which is called In God We Don't Trust. And it's really about the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And he argues some things that we might actually concede, which is that British control was not actually that oppressive, especially compared to state power in America today, that the taxes that were forced were fairly minuscule, and they were really too far away to take much interest in ruling. And so, you know, from compared to today, we might say that, you know, they were complaining about something that wasn't that big of a deal. But his second point is that the American Revolution was not only ill-advised or an overreaction, but that it was actually sinful, since Christians are supposed to obey the government even when it's inconvenient. Mm-hmm. And I partially agree with him on that, but I also partially disagree. So, you know, if you look at the New Testament, you're dealing with this context where Christians are outnumbered. They're in a society that's very pagan, that's very authoritarian, that's very concerned about social order and structure. And so you sort of have this thing that sort of comes in, that sort of the Christianity that says, well, women are basically are equal to men, that this divisions between men and women and slaves and masters and Jews and Gentiles don't really matter, that they're largely socially derived. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what does it mean to live in a culture that doesn't feel that way? And so what you sort of start seeing developing in the New Testament is these kind of like what you might call household codes, which are ways of saying, let's not stand out too much. We do have this liberty and this freedom in Christ to do this, but we should also be very careful that we're not, giving Christianity a bad reputation, that we're not attracting a lot of negative attention, that we're not attracting, in particular, state attention because of what the state is. And so, you know, that is, I think, part of what's going on with the New Testament model. So there is some, I think, there's something to be said for this idea that we should kind of, Christians in particular are called in the New Testament to sort of limit ourselves and limit our liberties even when it's inconvenient. So that's part of it. So I agree with that. The other thing is you have like Romans 13, so which those who are sort of Christians will probably hear that and cringe. Those who aren't Christians may not know what we're referring to, but that's the passage where Paul seems to say that, you know, the state is not a terror. The magistrate is not a terror to those who do good, only to those who do evil. So if you do the right thing, they'll leave you alone. Right. And so, and that in fact, in that regard, the magistrate is kind of like a servant of God. Mm-hmm. Because God desires that we live in an ordered society, that we, you know, that think we don't just sort of go around killing each other and letting, you know, thieves do what they want. And so that the state or the magistrate or governance or however you want to call that could be argued to serve like a divine function, right? And so Brousseau argues that. So he says, well, basically then to disobey the state is to disobey God. And he acknowledges some exceptions. But in general,
and the point, his point is, and that's why the colonists were wrong for violently opposing the, you know, King George, because
they were supposed to obey the state, and that in essence they were disobeying God because they disobeyed the state. And so I think the big problem that I took from that book was that Brousseau acknowledges one origin of the state, and the Bible discusses three. And so what Brousseau talks about is this sort of divine origin. Maybe I wouldn't say that the state comes from God, but that God in his sovereignty desires that there be some sort of an order that doesn't necessarily mean that God put Stalin in power or whatever. But that order is something that's good, right? But the problem is there's more. So like there's actually the Bible emphasizes to a great degree the demonic origins of the state. And there's also the human origins of the state. And so like, you know, on the human side, I mean, part of what's going on with Brousseau's argument that I think is sort of contradictory is, you know, now that, now after the Revolutionary War, and different people are in charge. Now we have to obey them. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so it's kind of arbitrary, right? It's just whoever right. happens to have used force to get in that position is the person you're supposed to obey.
Right. Like we could ask, well, what if it weren't for William the Conqueror, who knows, you know, why is King George in charge or something? Yes.
Right. Right. So I think, you know, you can argue for this kind of practical thing about Christians wanting to keep their head down and sort of, you know, liking the idea of order in general. But, you know, if you want to try to really put God, you say that God is behind the king, it's like, not quite. Mm-hmm. So, but the other part is there's this demonic origin of the state thing. And that's all throughout scripture. And just to kind of jump to like the New Testament, you have this temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. And Satan offers Jesus the kingdoms of the world if he'll bow down and worship Satan. And Jesus apparently agreed that Satan did actually have that power to hand out because he went on to refer to Satan as the god of this world multiple times in the Gospels. And other biblical authors agreed. So like Revelation, the book of Revelation, John describes Satan as like this dragon who controls and empowers the beast of empire. Mm-hmm. And that he looks forward to this day when the dragon and the beast will both be thrown into the lake of fire. And so you have all these kind of passages that emphasize this sort of demonic, Daniel 10 is an example that behind each empire, behind the Grecian empire, behind the Persian empire, you have these spiritual forces that are interacting. So anyway, I could multiply those examples, but I don't think it's sufficient, suffice it to say, to just quote Romans 13 and say, well, God sovereignly uses political power to achieve his ultimate ends. Therefore, the state is always right. We should always obey the state. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, even if you want to talk about kind of lean on that sovereignty aspect, right? Well, God also sovereignly uses Satan and he also sovereignly uses hell. But that doesn't mean we should affiliate with them. Right.
Right. Right.
And so it's, yeah. So that's kind of my take on what Berceau is doing there, that I think in some ways he makes a good argument that it probably was not something that Christians should have been doing, that, you know, to say we're going to get behind this war, that we're going to do yada, yada, yada. But where I think he errs is to say that the reason that we shouldn't have done that is because God wants us to obey the King of England because God sovereignly put the King of England in this place. It's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah. I mean, we've had plenty of guests on this podcast talking about Romans 13 and it's, and my reaction to it is sort of like, forget, you know, libertarianism or, but just in general, I understand prima facie. It looks like Paul is saying a lot there, but he couldn't possibly mean what it sounds like he's saying. And I admit that's a weird thing for him, but it's like, certainly we're not going to say, well, the only reason Pontius Pilate punished Jesus because Jesus must've done something wrong. You know, I mean, like nobody would say that. That's clearly not what Paul believed. So yeah. I agree, you know, it's an awkward thing to try to explain that what seems to be the plain text reading of what Paul wrote there. But on the other hand, it's not because, oh, I need to do that right. to rescue my anarcho-capitalism. It's that, no, just in general, like to reconcile that with the rest of the Gospels or the New Testament, I should say, you know, clearly there's some apparent conflict. And there's clear examples in the Old Testament of God's people disobeying direct orders from, you know, Pharaoh or whoever. So,
yeah. And that's, I mean, that's something that's a great observation. So that's something I've argued elsewhere, that Paul can't really believe that if you only do what's right, then that the state will not be a terror to you, as he says, that the state's going to leave you alone, that they'll actually pat you on the back and congratulate you and say, you're doing such a great job. Because Paul worships a guy who he believes was sinless, right? Mm-hmm. And he was crucified. Paul, I think at the time he wrote the book of Romans, he'd been beaten and whipped and left for dead by those in power, right? So, and then Israel's story is about these sort of evil people who come in and conquer and treat them horribly. You mentioned Pharaoh. And so, yeah, you're 100% right. There's something going on in Romans 13 that's a little bit difficult to put your finger on. And so some have argued that we should read Romans 13 as a best case scenario. Like this is kind of what prescriptively government should be doing, right? And that makes some sense that, you know, if Paul's talking about this is what should happen. But he also sort of, he says like, you know, do what's right and you won't have to worry. It's like, well, I mean, he seems to be speaking descriptively, right?
Yeah.
And so there's another idea that was raised by a theologian named T.L. Carter. He argued that Paul was perhaps using irony, or what we might sort of today is sort of call sarcasm. And there's reasons for thinking that. Other than, so we mentioned some of them, which is Paul's own background militates against a plain reading of the text. But also at the end of Romans 12, leading into Romans 13, which is part of his argument, he quotes Deuteronomy 32, and it's about, he says, leave vengeance to God. Vengeance is mine. I'll repay, say the Lord, says the Lord, right? And he's quoting from Deuteronomy 32, and Deuteronomy 32 is about God getting vengeance against these evil pagan kingdoms that have become enemies of Israel, right? And so he quotes this passage before he jumps into Romans 13. And so he's talking about pagan states oppressing God's people. So he drops this little hyperlink back. So if you go back and you read what he's talking about, it's about evil pagans oppressing God's people. And so there's some kind of tension there. So what T.L. Carter sort of argued is maybe Paul is trying to say something that might not be as easily perceptible from a flat reading. So that if someone in authority were to get a copy of this letter, they would say, hey, Paul seems like he's a good guy. He's on our side. He wants them to obey the laws, right? But that in fact, Paul does, you know, want them to get along with the state and do that kind of stuff. But that in reality, he's sort of saying that God is going to destroy these evil people who are oppressing you because they're not doing this. Because here's all the things they say they're doing. Here's what they should be doing if they're doing something kind of right. But you know, in point of fact, that that's not what they're doing. And so that means that, you know, be patient because they're going to face the wrath of God.
So that's interesting. It seems like maybe a poor man's version of a like how Jesus answered the should we pay the tax to Caesar? And how he gave an answer that was like nobody could possibly argue with what he said. It was almost a tautology. And yet you say, wait a minute, so should we pay it or not? It wasn't obvious what he meant. And so like it was kind of the perfect answer to disarm. So like the Romans couldn't get mad at him for because he didn't clearly say don't pay the tax. But yet, you know, the people who thought he was the Messiah who was going to liberate them also couldn't get mad that he didn't clearly say, oh, yeah, you have to pay it. So you're saying the argument was that maybe Paul was writing something that wouldn't superficially attract attention and look like he was saying, hey, everybody, you got to revolt if they do X, Y, Z. But yet the people in the know would be like, oh, wait a minute. No, I get what he's saying here.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and it's a little bit complicated because, like I said, I don't think that Paul is in favor of revolt. I think Paul wants Christians to, you know, get along as well as they can in the society where they happen to be. I think that Paul would have said, yeah, you know, pay your taxes. And essentially he does in that chapter. And I don't think he's being sarcastic when he says pay your taxes. I think he's sort of saying, just do it, you know?
Right.
But yes, I don't think that a super plain, simple reading on the surface that says, if you do everything right, the government will leave you alone. I agree with you. It can't be what Paul means because he knows better, right?
Yeah. Have you heard the interpretation that the one I can't remember like a good proponent of this, but I've seen the idea or the theory that if you read the text, he's saying, you know, the authorities will do such as, or God has given, and that the point was, so somebody who's abusing that office, they're not actually the authority. Like that's the loophole that I've seen some people give. Have you ever encountered that theory?
It could be. Yeah. So, I mean, if what Paul is saying is like kind of a prescriptive instead of a descriptive type thing, this is what those in authority should be doing. There is kind of an implication with that, that if those who are in authority are not doing this, then they're not just and they're not legitimate and you should ignore them. So, yeah, you could definitely get that reading out of there.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I'm just saying that was one that I saw that. Okay. Yeah, I could see that. So I was a bit like, so I liked your chapter, but then I was a bit, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. What I thought you were going to address was you as an Anabaptist, you know, what I'm saying is you looked at a particular Anabaptist argument as to why the American Revolution was sinful and you didn't like his particular reasons, but could you give your own reasons? Because I get this a lot too, that's one of the arguments when I was talking about pacifism, like on LouRockwell.com years ago at this point, some people would email me and say, oh, you know, yeah, I get it, Bob, in general, I don't like a lot of what the U.S. government does, or, but would you, you're saying you don't like the American Revolution? You, even that, you wish the colonists had just, and I went through and, you know, I said, yeah, I actually think that, you know, the people living in what we now call the United States would have been better off had they not violently opposed the British Empire. So anyway, yeah. What are your thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think part of the assumption of those who would maybe criticize you there is that the cost to life and the cost in terms of treasure was worth it because of some sort of principle. Mm-hmm. And like, and that's, I mean, that's kind of a debate that's going on right now with kind of Russia and Ukraine, right? It's like, well, on the one hand, Ukraine, of course, has a right to self-defense, mm-hmm. You know, setting aside the whole collective state type stuff.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But it's like, at this point, is that in their best interest? And like, so it's a really tough kind of question to answer. And sort of as third parties, it's a little difficult because I kind of sort of feel like on one level, it's not my role to adjudicate that. But like looking back and just kind of trying to apply some biblical principles to what's going on in the American Revolution. Yeah, I agree. It was not worth that cost. I think Brian Kaplan's made a similar argument, right? That it was just not worth it, mm-hmm. in terms of what the cost was, that it would have been better to just go ahead and pay the, you know, 1% tea tax or whatever, than to, you know, actually send your children and off to die fighting.
Or yeah. I mean, or even just not pay the tax and just say, okay, sure. You know what I mean? And just like, yeah, they're going to come in and, you know, they might throw a bunch of us in jail or whatever. Are they just going to murder everybody and then they're not going to get any tax revenue that way either, you know? Yeah. So
that's a fourth option, yeah. Right? Civil resistance, but not mm-hmm. violent civil resistance. Yeah. Yeah. And then if you go back, I mean, we think in terms of the Tories and the rebels, but yet there's another group that's there, which are the Quakers, who sort of say, it's not our business. It's not our kingdom. We don't care. Mm-hmm. And they weren't exactly Anabaptists because Quakers don't practice the sacraments, but they're influenced by the Anabaptists and they're nonviolent. So they're using a lot of those same arguments. But you could make, like, there's a fourth group of people that we could imagine. And in fact, I think there were some acts of nonviolent resistance in the revolution as well. But yeah, who just say, yeah, we are rebels in a sense, but that doesn't mean that we're willing to kill for it. Mm-hmm. That is not a moral cost that we're willing to pay. That's not a, you know, just sort of a cost in terms of time or treasure or life that we're willing to pay, but we are willing to rebel because we feel like we have a right to do so. Yeah. So yeah, that's another way you could approach
it. And two, like I would argue with libertarians who, you know, are big gung ho about the American Revolution that, I mean, my historical understanding is not great, but I mean, I think they used conscription and stuff and they certainly used taxation. You know what I mean? So I could argue and say, well, clearly, just if you think that people who lived in the colonies had the moral right to go shoot at British soldiers, okay, but that still doesn't justify, you know, the colonial governments organizing an official colonial army that goes out and you know what I mean? Right. And I could argue, and that would have been a lot better than, I mean, it's kind of stupid. And I know in practice, they did kind of resort to guerrilla warfare and stuff, and that's kind of how they managed to win, that if they had just had, you know, open battles out in the fields, they would have gotten slaughtered. And so anyway, but my point is just to push that even further and saying, right. And it's also ironic too, because a lot of the people that are the most gung ho about, yeah, the founding fathers, and they weren't a bunch of chickens like you, Murphy, and blah, blah, blah. They're the precise ones right now who hate our country so much because look at how far we've fallen. And Ben Franklin would be disgusted with it. It's like, right. So it didn't work. You know what I mean? This great experience, like if we could only go back and this time we mean it, you know what I mean? So it's like, even in their own framework, the experiment was great for a while and then it failed. And I'm going to say, well, maybe it's partly because at the core you were turning to violence to try to make the world a better place. And maybe that's not a good thing to do.
Right. Yeah. The effects, well, the end is consistent with the means, that, you know, what you, what you put out is what you're going to get back. Yeah. I think, maybe this would be a controversial, comparison to make, but you could argue that the American Revolution was a bit like January 6th. Not in that it was an actual successful revolution or anything, but in that, like, you sort of have these people who are ruling over you and you reject it and you object to it and you say, I don't want these people ruling over me. I'm going to fight to stop that from happening. I want this idiot to rule me instead. And it's like, you know, even though you appreciate the sentiment of where they're going with it, what we ended up with was, I mean, it ultimately has not been a significant win for freedom. And not just in the long run over the course of, you know, 250 years or whatever. I mean, pretty much immediately what we got was not consistent with what we'd call libertarian principles today.
Right. And if a lot of the people, you know, who would make that argument very patriotic, you know, they, when you say, when did things go wrong? I think a lot of them have come around to, oh yeah, actually the Constitution isn't good. You know, like the Articles of right. Confederation, that was pretty good. That was all right. You know, and then it was those, oh man. And they went to that framework and they just kind of usurped the power, and the delegates didn't tell them to go make a constitution. They just did that. You know, so I'm just saying that for people who think like that, that for me, for like you or me to say, okay, maybe just turn the clock back a little bit and question even the American Revolution. Could they? So again, it's for people not mistaken. It's not that they should have just said, okay, King George, you're awesome, and we'll just do whatever you say and not protest or do anything. But the point is, was it necessary to, you know, you could even push it further and say like the Boston Tea Party and stuff, like, you know, I don't know, grabbing private property and throwing it in the water. I don't know that that's a good thing to do. And then dressing up like Indians right. to blame it on them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. This is a bit protectionistic if you think of it that way. No, I agree. I had a thought and I think I might've lost it. May have flown away. It's flown away. So we can move on if you want. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, we're coming up on time here. So what do you want to say in closing to kind of give people a commercial for why they should read this? Maybe I'll do it that way. Like, suppose someone's like, either I'm not religious, but I'm libertarian. You know, does that person want to read this? Yeah. Or someone who's like, yeah, I'm Christian, but I'm a Christian libertarian even, but I'm not an Anabaptist. Like, am I going to get something out of this book?
Yeah. So I think what is valuable about the book is that I'm arguing that pretty much almost 200 years before that classical liberal tradition that we value so much came about, you had a group of these kind of weird Christians who had discovered those principles in the New Testament. And like, that's kind of astounding, but basically they picked up the New Testament, they looked at it and they said, freedom of religion, separation of church and state, that there actually are limits to what government should do. That war profiteering is bad. That, you know, they said a lot of these things that I think maybe were not as developed as, you know, where like Rothbard would be or whatever. But what's kind of fascinating is they were kind of the only ones who were saying it, and they said it before the secular tradition developed. So I think what I'm sort of doing, especially for I think libertarian Christians, you know, if you're a Methodist or Catholic or Reformed or whatever. You know, and you're also a libertarian, thank God, I'm happy to have you. But, you know, the roots of those traditions were not necessarily libertarian. And so there's kind of had to be this accommodation where it's like, well, I'm Catholic, but I'll kind of fit my libertarianism in here and I'll saw off the edges of Catholicism that don't fit and kind of make it work. And what I'm sort of arguing is you had this group of Christians who kind of from get-go were already thinking these kinds of thoughts, and they were working on putting them together in a way that made sense, that they were trying to sort of consistently live that out. And so I think there's value in looking at those people, especially if you're a Christian, but even if you're just a libertarian or an anarchist, to sort of, and you're interested in that history, because just everybody I know who's an anarchist loves, you know, reading about that kind of stuff, the history of thought and the history of libertarian thought. I think this would be a good book to kind of help you to start, kind of maybe filling in a little gap there in that history of libertarian thought, because I think the Anabaptists had some wonderful insights that were pretty unique to them for the time.
Okay, well, great. So folks, my guest has been Cody Cook. His book is The Anarchist Anabaptist, Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom. That's just come out from the Libertarian Christian Institute Press. So Cody, thanks for writing the book and coming here to talk about it.
Hey, thanks for inviting me. I'm really excited to meet you. I've read your stuff, listened to your podcast. So this is a thrill for me to be here. Thanks, Bob.
I appreciate it. Thanks. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.